Hi, my name is Joey Ito. I'm the new director of the MIT Media Lab, and we're going to try to show you some interesting things today and talk to you about where we're headed. But first, because we have some weird demos that hopefully will work, we want to introduce the demos at the beginning because they are sort of interactive things that are affected by the talk. So what do you want to talk about this one first? First of all, many of us on the panel have these galvanic skin response sensors, which are, I'll let you describe.
Okay,
so.
They should all be on.
Yeah. This is really nice and intimate. I like it. So what we're wearing is, these sensors that we're wearing measure our electrodermal activity, which is just fancy words for sweat. So we have sweat glands beneath our dermal layer, and as we get excited or aggravated or stressed
or nervous,
they tend to fill up, and we measure the conductance of the skin using this sensor. So notice the blue over there, the blue graph, well, that's actually mine. I'm fairly stressed. and
which one am I?
You're the cat. So no response there. We'll see what that means. But anyway. So these sensors are manufactured now by a company which was spun out by the lab called Affectiva. And hopefully we'll track some of our responses throughout the panel today.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that we're iterating on at the lab is how to make conferences more interesting and try to change the format. One of the easy, obvious things is to put speaker stress levels above them, behind them. We don't know that just exactly that format is going to be the best, but something like that. And then the next one, Catherine, you want to?
Okay, oops. So. Come back. Okay, so what we basically have here is a semantic map of what you're all tweeting. You might have noticed the hashtag SX Media Lab. If you tweet up there, this isn't just a Twitter fall, and it's not just looking at words. Basically, what we've been doing in an open source project that's started at the Media Lab but is international now is we've been building a model of how people think about the world. And we use that model to basically understand connections between emotions and goals and topics, and we're using that to understand, hopefully do deep semantic analysis on what people are tweeting about this panel. So if the first demo was the panel, the second demo this is sort of you, all of you. And we're trying to do that to make things a little bit more exciting. This is also something in collaboration with a spin-out of the Media Lab called Luminoso, which works on semantic understanding and helping make conferences and other things more exciting by matching people together and helping people network.
Thanks, Catherine. So we'll be switching back and forth between these demos, and hopefully some of the tags will inform the Q&A. And we've left plenty of time at the end for a lot of discussion. So if you have thoughts about what you want to talk about, go ahead and tweet them, but also we'll have an open mic at the end as well. So I wanted to start off first by kind of framing what the Media Lab is and where it's going. And I decided, first of all, this is the first meeting of Occupy South by Southwest by the Media Lab, and so we'll have a section at the end explaining how we're doing that. But in order to understand where the Media Lab's going, I was sort of an odd choice for the director of the Media Lab, so I think what I'll do is I'll describe a little bit of my trajectory and Media Lab's trajectory, and you can see what the collision trajectory of that will look like. For those of you who don't know me, my background is mostly in the internet entrepreneur and nonprofit space, and I really think a lot about the internet and the evolution of man, because I think the internet has impacted our evolution more than just about anything right now. And so, you know, I split the world into the world before the internet, when things were simple and easy to understand and actually kind of under control, and then the world after the internet, when things became very exciting, but kind of out of control, very complex. It's a completely different world. And some companies still are BI, and some companies have switched to AI, and academic institutions are still trying to figure out, I think, where they are in the internet today. Just very quickly, I mean, this is the old, I helped start the first commercial internet service provider in Japan. So this is my first sort of life after internet. But our competition was a network system called X25. And it was really, you know, large companies with experts going to intergovernmental agencies, making huge specifications that only big companies could render into product and consumers would use this, and go around and around really slowly, centered around big companies and research labs with lots of authority and lots of money. And it was very good when you had to anticipate every single problem and anticipate every single thing. That could be good as well because you couldn't change things later. Well, it turns out in software you can change things later, and when software went to the network, you can kind of figure it out as you went along. So the internet was decentralized. Everybody was kind of connected to the network together. You had 12-year-olds participating in standards bodies. It was kind of chaotic, but it kind of worked. And this is the first commercial internet provider in Japan in my toilet. And it's messy and it's sloppy, and this is a VT100 terminal that only half the screen worked. But it worked because the whole point of the internet was that you could connect anything to it, and it was about being scrappy. And it was really the key thing here, the key point here is it was a triumph of distributed innovation over centralized innovation. It was a triumph of kind of figuring out as you go along over planning. And ever since then, we know now that we have the internet that you can actually apply this to many other things, and that the internet is not a technology, it's a philosophy, which actually will tie into the Media Lab. So David Weinberger, one of my favorite guys, calls it small pieces loosely joined. It's a network of innovation. If you think about the great innovations on the internet, who created TCP/IP, the web, the browser, these are all small groups of academics or small groups of scrappy programmers that are connected together by sort of open standards. It wasn't some big Bell Labs or, I mean, there was some stuff that happened in the networks and Bell Labs, but the real innovation was happening with, I mean, I assume most of you are from the edge, right? It was us. And this is a graph from one of our faculty, Cesar Hidalgo, and just to go very quickly through this, if you think about this axis as the total amount of information in the world, and this is time, when you're making spears and pointed sticks, all the information you needed could fit in a human brain. So you never didn't really need to share that. And then as stuff got complex and you're building things like the Walkman, you had to have a lot of people. It was complex. You needed the firm. But it turns out today most of the stuff is that we need is more complex and goes beyond the cognitive limit of the organization, and we have networks and ecosystems of companies. And that's why we need to share. That's because doubling the number of people in IBM doesn't double the amount of complexity they can understand. They have to work in networks. And so the world has changed to networks. This is like the singularitarian's favorite chart, and I kind of like this too. This is the Moore's law, what everybody knows, which is that, you know, we've been, this is logarithmic, so geometrically increasing the amount of computing power every year. This, when you combine these things together, computers becoming geometrically faster, which means cheaper, and then the internet and the network and open source software making the cost of distribution and the cost of collaboration lower, you get cost of distribution, cost of collaboration, and cost of production to nearly zero. And what that does is that changes the cost of networks and nodes, the cost of distribution and creation, which fundamentally lowers the cost of innovation. And this is what's key, because in the old days, if you wanted to create a venture business to do software, you had to raise tens of millions of dollars. That means you had to be able to go and raise money on a plan and then build it. Or you'd have to have a big research center. Well, today, most of the companies that I've invested in, or any company that you see here at South by Southwest, how are you going to raise money without a demo? You've got to have a demo first. So it's now you build first, raise later. And the reason you can build first, and if you go to Eric Ries's track, you'll see minimum viable product. You can make a minimum viable product in your garage over the weekend. And so the whole risk thing has changed completely. So now you don't, the innovation doesn't cluster around money and authority. The money and authority is chasing innovation that's happening on the edges. And so, but actually that's tied to the original philosophy of the internet. David Clark, who's also from MIT, for some reason, all the guys who actually make the standards are at MIT. All the people who use the standards and make shitloads of money are on the West Coast. But anyway, And they don't like standards, actually. They just like to use them. But David Clark said rough consensus running code, and he was one of the first architects of the internet on the network layer. Well, it turns out this is exactly what Eric Ries is saying when he says lean startups. It's about the same idea as agile software computing. And John Seely Brown, who was the chief scientist at Xerox PARC, has this great phrase, the power of pull, which is to pull the resources as you need them rather than stocking them. And if you think about this in terms of like education, I mean, if you took a computer science class because 10 years from now you may use it, that's kind of probably stupid. Well, I guess it depends on the computer science class. But if you learn Fortran, that's not necessarily help you when you want to use it is 10 years from now. And for whether it's information or knowledge or networks, it actually is faster, cheaper, and more timely to pull things together as you need them and learn things as you need them and be interest-driven and project-oriented than to try to stock everything. And it's the same with companies. And again, your mileage may vary. If you're in the humanities and you're studying English literature, this may not apply to you as much. If you're an internet startup, it definitely applies to you. But basically, the idea also is you have to throw away your map because life is now after internet and very complex. So the problem is this internet service provider, I was trying to get this funded. I needed $600,000, and Japanese companies do this thing where they do these things called feasibility study corporations. So they set up a company to discuss and deliberate the feasibility of spending $600,000, and they spent $3 million to decide not to invest $600,000. And it turns out that making the map now costs more than trying it. And this gets back to the agile, the lean startup, the minimum viable product. Just do the thing. You do need a compass. You do need to kind of know where you're going. So it's very important for all of us at the Media Lab to somewhat tune our compasses so we're going in the right direction. But we don't really kind of micromanage what we want to do. We don't even try not to have a plan as much as possible. Anytime you can get away without a plan, you should. Because if you have a plan, you can't get lucky. You don't have serendipity. And serendipity is about peripheral vision. And if you're focused on a plan, you have a bunch of regular meetings, and you're stuck to the plan, you really can't get lucky. And serendipity is about noticing things in your peripheral vision that may turn out to be really valuable. And I think so many companies that have plans and pivots, when we talk about lean startups and agile, you know, like YouTube, 2005, dating site with video, you know, it didn't take them very long to figure out they needed to pivot and become video Flickr for video, and that didn't work. And they pivoted to video for MySpace, and that worked. If that had been a three-year plan, you know, and an NSF grant, they would never have been able to pivot away from that. And then lastly, this is one of my favorite philosophers, Timothy Leary. And he has this, my favorite quote from him is, question authority and think for yourself. And it doesn't mean disrespect authority and kick him in the shins. It means question authority and think for yourself. You don't get a Nobel Prize by doing as you're told. You get a Nobel Prize by taking the biggest truth you can find and proving it's wrong and coming up with a new one. And so much of education, so much of business is people telling you the answer or teaching you so that you have the answer. And so how do you teach people, how do you get people, entrepreneurs or academics or students, to question authority rigorously, think for themselves, and do something about it? That's actually the hardest thing to teach, but I think one of the most important things. We already talked about this. This is Moore's Law again. So one thing about Moore's Law and these networks is it turns out 3D printers, laser cutters, low-cost manufacturing in China, all the reasons why we had agility in software are now happening in hardware. And so this is really cool for the Media Lab because we have a bunch of hardware geeks. I think what happened, which is startups taking over innovation from the big companies, is going to happen. Really, this year is a pivotal point where hardware from startups is going to go. We've got some. We've got Square. We've got Amazon getting into hardware. But this is a huge wave that's going to come. And so that all the stuff that we're talking about in software, a lot of those things will apply. And it turns out it's going to happen in biotech, too, because we can now print gene sequences. We can print all the way up to bacteria now. And pretty soon you'll be printing food, and you'll be growing stuff. And so it's going to be a competition of the organic biologists versus the micro-robot people about who's going to make your better eye next. Sorry, these slides have repeated. Okay, so let me talk a little bit about the Media Lab. Our academic program is called Media Arts and Science. So when we say media, it's very broad. Actually, this is a sort of inside story. I think they tried to use the word communication at the beginning, but MIT said, no, you can't use communication. Too many. We use that for real science. But media, you can have that. That's like, that doesn't really mean anything. But it turns out it's great because it didn't really mean anything. So when we say media, we mean synthetic molecular biology. We mean opera. We mean buildings. We mean just about anything that you can express in, including software. So media is the expression. Whatever we do, we express stuff. We build stuff. So we don't do theory. We don't. Some of us write papers, but that's not the focus. It's not about the scholarship. It's about, can you express this in an interesting way? And arts and science is really a balance. It's design and engineering. It's arts versus hard science. And the synthesis in that arts providing the context where we can connect this deep science and this engineering together. And this together, arts, science, and expression is really the key thing of the Media Lab. This is a new building that I lucked into because it's brand new, but I didn't have to raise the money for it. But it was really designed around the philosophy of the Media Lab, which is we have these very open lab spaces where you can see into the other labs, and several labs usually occupy space like this where you have the offices, and then we have this sort of atelier kind of hacking building space. Just some statistics because it sort of matters. It was created 25 years ago, or over 25 years ago, by Nicholas Negroponte and Jerome Wiesner, who was the president of MIT at the time. And they really, what they did, just to be kind of blunt about it, is they picked all the misfits at MIT and brought them together and gave them a home. Because it turns out, I mean, MIT is not a full-blown university, so there are a lot of fields, there are a lot of things that you actually don't have homes for at MIT. And when you pull them all together, you get this really amazing, multidisciplinary, eclectic crew who are working together. So we now have 26 faculty, around 140 or 150 students who are master's students or PhDs in our program. And we have another important thing is we have 300 plus research projects and 70 plus sponsors. The sponsors are important because the rest of MIT, I think, is around 90% government funded and it's mostly directed funding. And we have what we call undirected corporate funding. So if, you know, Catherine says, hey, we have this project and I need a tissue scientist and somebody who understands music, can we go? We can say, yeah, go. Whereas if you're working on an NSF grant or an NEA grant, it's going to be pretty hard to sort of veer off. And so these directed research is really important when you're trying to go deep, and it sustains a tremendous amount of important work. So I don't want to poo-poo directed research. But if you only have directed research, you end up doing things where you already know the answer before you start. Almost by definition, if you're writing a grant, that means you have to explain what you're going to do to somebody who doesn't really understand what you're trying to do, and then you have to prove to them that you've done it, which is very different from getting money to say, think of, so our metrics are uniqueness, massive impact, and magic. And if you think you've got that, go, right? And our things take weird paths, and we can talk more about some examples. But that's sort of the key thing, is we've got a core budget of about $35 million that just goes into undirected research where people are allowed to be a little bit anti-disciplinary. So anti-disciplinary, I think the first time it was used in print is actually our faculty search that we're doing right now. We're trying to hire two more arts faculty. So anti-disciplinary means, so a lot of people use interdisciplinary or multidisciplinary. Well, we're actually anti-disciplinary. And what that means is that if what you're trying to do can fit in some other discipline or department, you should go there because that means you can do it with your peers and you can go deep. If what you are trying to do can't fit anywhere else in the world, that's the kind of people we want, whether you're faculty or student. That's the sort of people we want at the Media Lab. Now, that was all Media Lab before I joined. And one of the things that I noticed when I got to the Media Lab was it was 25 years old, and if you think 25 years back, there was no internet. There was no PC, personal computer revolution. It was started back when we were just trying to figure out, it was like the Doug Engelbart sort of Nicholas Negroponte writing Being Digital. You know, people were, like I think Henry was involved, it's like multimedia workstations on everyone's desks. Oh my God, no way, that's never gonna happen. That was back 25 years ago. And so that was really about man-machine, empowering the individual, figuring out interfaces, figuring out the future of hardware. Today, 25 years later, we have the internet. Things are networked, things are social, kind of the trends are talk, things are agile, stuff is happening on the edges and less in the center. So we need to change things at the Media Lab. A lot of it's already been changing. I mean, I think there's a general trend among the students and things like that, but I'm trying to change some of the things formally. And so when you have that nice building that I showed you, it's kind of comfortable, and you sit there, and these guys like, you know, eat warm cookies, and not exactly, but they sit around and they hack with each other, and it's a great community. But on the other hand, and we do collaborate, but on the other hand, it's easy to not and end up not going out very much, and it's kind of hard to understand from the outside. So one of the things that I really think is we need to change the Media Lab's image of itself and from the outside, from a container to more of a platform. Because on the internet, I always think about platforms. And in a way, it sort of happens automatically by connecting the Media Lab more to the internet and participating in a conference like this in a more substantial way. The other part is products to ecosystems. So this is just that network cognitive limit of the organization thing. But in the old days, I think companies came to us looking for ideas to make single products. But now it's much more about how is the future of this ecosystem going to change? How can I collaborate with other people? How do we collaborate with other institutions? And so we want to work more and more on convening, on networking, and on connecting things together to help our sponsors, our funders, create ecosystems, and also add other people. So the Knight Foundation and other foundations are now becoming members of the Media Lab. I want to have not just big companies become members of the Media Lab, but to involve a lot of other people so that we can have impact in places like the developing world, in places like nonprofits and foundations and policy and things like that. So I've changed the name. We don't call our funders sponsors anymore. We call them members. And it's a membership organization where we can hopefully make all of you members, because we're going to turn this into a network. So we're calling it, I guess this is maybe the first public time I'm using network with a capital N. But so the Media Network, so the internet is a network of networks. So the Media Lab is a network of people that include our faculty and students, include our member companies, but it also includes everybody that interacts with us. And I want to make it easier and easier to interact with us, and I also want to interact with other networks. I was just over at Stanford talking to them about how can we connect our networks together, and things like that. So to me, how do we transform the Media Lab as this sort of very cool, very innovative, lots of internet DNA institution into something that's more distributed, more of a network? And one of the things, I mean, and I was sort of half joking about Occupy South By, I do want to start having a Media Lab presence at a lot of the major conferences and figure out how to make this more of a thing. And so we've got like over 20 people and over a dozen panels that are Media Lab populated in some way. And so what would be great is if you guys can also interact with some of the other Media Lab stuff that's going on here and give us some feedback, because one of the really important things for me is to try to understand what the right interface is with people who want to do cool stuff. And with that, can we switch to... You've got another demo to show. Okay. And by the way, we're sort of making this up as we go along, so...
It's certainly a thing where live demoing is a long and glorious Media Lab tradition.
Demo or die.
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay, so this is a mock-up of our installation, which is at the Omni Hotel. And yes, this is a shameless pimping, but I don't mind. So please go there. Now, what we're asking you to do is contribute your some of your Facebook data. And what we actually want is your hometown and your friends' hometowns, and then we build this network. Now, you could see on the screen a network of one of our Media Labbers, so you could see who's his friends' hometowns, where they came from, how they're connected. And you could also see smaller dots, and the smaller dots are just the global network of the people that contribute to the data. And Eva, who's standing there waving, he's trying to control the globe with his hand. See, he's moving it left, he's moving it right. Very nice, Eva. But in the real installation, we actually have control over that. We're using Kinect, and you can come up to the installation and contribute your data and then control the globe with your hands and visualize your own network. So we also have another part of the installation, which is, I'd say, analog.
It's the anti-Kinect. I'll talk later about that.
Okay, thanks, guys. So, you want to do the, is it the introduction?
Do you want me to do it?
So go ahead.
All right, given that I'm the probably the first person in the line who has introduced themselves, I'm Catherine Havasi. I'm a research scientist at the Media Lab, where I work on getting computers to understand language the way a person would. So we do everything from trying to build immersive storytelling devices that will sit on a table and listen to people talk and change color in the room around them, to text understanding and helping doctors interact better with their patients by, well, giving them feedback on their bedside manner.
I'm Yadid. I'm a grad student and a research assistant at the Affective Computing Group. It's affective with an A, not an E. And we deal with, I'd say, emotion-enabled technology. So it's developing technologies that that make machines detect human emotion. Use it in both. We use it in medical applications. We use it for nonverbal populations. Basically, any use you could think of: marketing, health, wellness, and these sensors are part of the research I'm doing there.
Yves Alexandre.
Yeah. So. Personally, my background is applied math, so most of what I do at the Media Lab is really using this kind of data, the data that you give us, other type, credit card record.
Get closer to the mic.
Oh, sorry. So yeah, going through this kind of data, building theories, searching for patterns in large-scale data. And I would say probably because using and dealing with on a daily basis with this kind of data is something that I find at the same time fascinating and also terrifies me. I'm working, I would say, during the night with a small nonprofit which is called ID Cubed, which is also here at South by Southwest. And they're trying to bring lawyers and technologists together to put the user back in control, to have the user be the one controlling his data and be the one taking advantage of his data.
So is your data something, right?
Yeah, it's the one that's changing
you know,
a lot.
You know, he went to Taco Bell when he came to Austin.
Did it
change much?
Did it spike?
Anyway, sorry. Yeah. I just wanted to make sure it was working.
Yeah, the sensor is on.
So hi, everyone. My name's Andy Bartigi. I'm in the object-based media group, and I'm excited about imaging and display technologies, and I think I'm...
What?
I think I'm probably also one of the outliers on the panel. My background is electrical engineering. I build hardware, and frankly, high-level languages kind of terrify me. So
we're all outliers. That's why we're in the Media Lab.
So I think I want to offer one anecdote, and I think it's an anecdote that gets thrown around a lot of the groups and a lot of the conversations we have. It usually the conversations start with, do you remember that Star Trek episode where they had a... Or it's like, do you know in Hogwarts where the walls... We're going to build that. And it needs to be done by the third week of April because that's when we do the demos. And so that's usually how a lot of the anecdotes happen. Demo or dies is one of the oldest mottos we have in the lab. Absolutely embraced.
Yeah, and that's... I mean, the neat thing is because we have these... The diversity and people who are just focused on this... Literally, the mailing list start in the morning with, wouldn't it be cool if, and then by the end of the day, you have a prototype, and then by the next day, the open source patterns are there, and everybody's building them. And it's really neat that I think that the software agile mentality is applying to hardware and biotech in our lab. And one of the things that I'd like to try to do as we build this Media Lab network is to see if we can export some of the Media Lab DNA around the sort of rapid prototyping and tinkering in hardware, and really the lack of fear around hardware, and bring in some of the entrepreneurial stuff from the West Coast and other areas. So one of the things we're working on is a postgraduate program for entrepreneurs, or students who want to become entrepreneurs and things like that. So again, want to make this as inclusive as possible and get lots of people involved. And the next, we're going to go through the list of other more Media Lab stuff and then open it up.
All right, so I'm... We're saying that we're occupying South By. We literally do have maybe two or three dozen members down here, numerous alumni, spinoffs, so on and so forth. So I'm going to attempt to plug a lot of them. And I think a bunch of people are in the audience, but I'm going to do this like rapid fire. So if you want to like stand or shout or wave, that'd be good. So we've already spoken about Luminoso. Do you want to?
I think we pretty much got it. We do text understanding, so we build...
Text understanding.
Yeah.
So Travis is going to be given a panel Tuesday. He's got a new... Is he here?
Monday.
Hey, Travis. So he's got a new communication system that uses lights, light bulbs and such. Foomf?
Fun. It's not German, you know.
Are you sure? Do you want to talk?
What?
Do you have a phrase?
For fun? Open sensing framework.
Yeah. Open sensing framework for Android. We also have ID cubed.
Yeah, I think we covered it.
We did? We covered it? Say it again. Okay, platform for exchanging personal information in a secure manner. We want to bring your data down from the cloud and into your pocket. We want to make it so that you can I probably just totally butchered the description.
Keep going.
We want to bring you back in control of your data so that you can more effectively share it with other partners, but we think that it's going to be beneficial for both you and the partners. Formlabs, these guys are probably hunting around in the audience somewhere. They've got new 3D printing technology.
Yeah, and they're slightly stealthy, so don't tell everything.
Well, they... Told me to.
They do stuff.
They do things.
No, but it's okay. They're a 3D printer company.
They're hiring.
Yes.
We've got Effectiva, which are the guys who are making these little polygraphs on my wrist right here, which are monitoring our every breath. SourceMap. So for a long time, there's been this problem of, you know, what we have these devices like iPhones, but if I'm a concerned consumer and I really want to monitor the sort of products that I consume, how do I make sure I know where every bit of every scrap of every ore that goes into the tiniest capacitor soldered onto the tiniest circuit board inside of this goes? And this is a tool to do that, SourceMap. And next, unfortunately, these are going to get a little bit more rapid fire. These are some of the panels and such that we've... I guess I should throw up the URL as well. These are some of the panels that the rest of our crew are hanging out in. I'm particularly excited about how STDs could be good for my health. Designing tomorrow's digital and physical interfaces is actually going to be about wearable and stitchable electronics. I should plug Henry and Alex's panel since they're both here and here. I think you guys are... Where are you? Are you on the next slide? Henry, what's the name of your panel?
We have to see your slides.
What's the name of your panel? Interaction Technologies. It's actually on the next slide. So, Interaction Technologies, Gesture Systems, and Beyond. We're going to talk about some of the next generation display, multimedia, sort of the cave environment for the 21st century. Civic media, the benevolent internet. And I want to plug one final thing. We've got a small art installation in the Omni, and this is sort of, we sort of have a juxtaposition of both this modern, high-tech data visualization with a Kinect and so on and so forth, with something that actually Alex and I have been working on, and I think we sort of hit this point where we realized that for the longest time, data visualizations are kind of locked up, and we really wanted to democratize those, and then we got a little bit excited about this idea of a patina. You know, if you have maybe a leather belt or a pair of shoes, and as you wear them, they get broken in, and you remember where you got that scratch and got that cuff. So what we've done is on one side we have this high-tech web-enabled map, and on the other we have a very simple map, and this is all in the Omni, based on the Omni. And what happens is we ask each participant, each creator of the artwork, to place a single sticker. One where they were born, one where they live, and one where they wish to live one day. And over time, we're hoping to build this piece of artwork, to build this visualization. And I think in the end, I'm probably going to hang it on the wall somewhere obnoxious in the media lab. But I think that's it. And I want to point you guys to our URL, which I'll edit and add back into the slides. But if you have any questions, you can tweet at us.
One of us should tweet the URL.
Yeah.
I'll tweet the URL.
But But the reason actually wasn't just to be shameless in terms of giving you all of this, because I think the difficulty is we have 350 projects, and I didn't want to go through all of them. But I think the importance is the diversity and the complexity of what we're trying to pull together. And so when you see all of the different panels, if you kind of keep an eye on me, like we just, and when we're doing this faculty search, we're looking for people in fields that we don't yet know about. And so it's really kind of this really anti thing. And it's so now that I'm getting in the Media Lab, I'm having a harder time explaining it. So I wanted to try to make this rest of this session a little bit more interactive. So, and I don't know, maybe it's not that important for everybody to understand what it is, but I think if we're gonna have an impact on the world, it'd be great if people understood what we're good for and what we're not good at, because obviously we're solving a very specific need, I think, in research, which is to have this really crazy, completely undirected thing that pops up with ideas that you couldn't do elsewhere. All the stuff like super colliders and stuff like that, that's great. We love CERN, you know, we hang out with them too, but we're sort of the not that stuff. And with that, I think if you guys want, there's a mic up here if anybody has questions. I don't know if anybody's been following Twitter. And we can go on and on if there's no questions too. But
there are a lot of you. I'm sure some of you have questions.
And it's kind of a pain. But if you could come to the mic, that'd be helpful. Thanks.
Oh, sorry.
Hi guys. My name is Mike Mark. One of my things that I'm really interested in is tangible media and gesture technology. And so from the wearable tangible media and gesture technology interfaces to the lights that Nathan's working on, I was just wondering how you guys see the future of gesture technology and tangible media.
So gestures are different than tangible, right?
Okay.
Well, not necessarily.
They interact in a lot of ways,
so,
yeah.
So is there anybody here from any of those groups from the Media Lab that can talk to this?
Maybe Alex and Henry. So Alex and Henry are going to have a panel about this.
Yeah. Well, Henry, maybe you can just come up and give a brief response. Or not.
Yeah, sure.
And also move the mic
back. Henry's one of our research scientists and has been in the Media Lab forever.
Hi. So as I said, we'll be doing a panel on Sunday at 12:30, right?
The mic is close, yeah.
Here,
is the
Henry.
Yeah, what? You just have to be closer to the mic.
Close, really close, Henry.
To this microphone? Yeah. Okay,
yes.
Good. In short, I would say that my approach to this is we want to make technology disappear largely and not look like things that we recognize as technology, but rather have our bodies understood by technology and have our interactions with the world understood with technology. And so that's where I think you're right, the tangibles and gestures come together quite strongly. And so it's a lot less about how do we interact with each other through technology and a lot more about just interacting with each other assisted by technology.
Okay.
So that's my philosophy on that.
Okay. So you think they'll interact, these two interfaces, with the spaces as well as wearable?
I do, because I think, again, to me, we want to make the keyboards disappear. We want to make the mice disappear. At some level, we might even want to make the screens disappear into the environment. And so what's left is that technology observes us in other ways.
That's exciting.
Yeah, thanks.
All right, thanks.
Thanks, man.
Hi. I'm a software company, and I'm really interested. I don't have a $35 million budget to give to a team of people who I can kind of task with being anti-disciplinary, but yet I'm really interested in the brilliant people that work with me having some mission that says that they can kind of go off and they don't have to be strictly disciplined in how they think and how they work. So maybe you could share a little bit with me about how you can provide folks with the freedom to think outside of the usual way that you need to think to get the job done and have the space to be creative and still have something to show for it at the end of the day.
So there's, I mean, it depends on the size of your company a little bit, but, you know, well, first of all, being agile is something as a software company that you can definitely do, and there's a whole track with Eric Ries on that, which if you don't do agile, and okay, so then, so you've got that part. I think the other thing that's kind of important that I've noticed, and so we're all kind of discretionary, but even if you have a strong track, especially for big companies, I'm finding that like Google's 20% time, you can actually trace that all the way back to, I don't know, to scotch tape and post-its and things like that, but allowing people to do things that aren't necessarily their mission. And this is back to peripheral vision. A lot of people come to the Media Lab and say, wow, that's so cool, I wish I could do that, but that's not part of my job. And one of the things I think that's important even in a smaller company is to give enough room for people to be allowed to do things that aren't necessarily their job, because that's sometimes where the really interesting serendipitous stuff happens. I think conferences are great, you know, because like South by Southwest is kind of like a virtual Media Lab. You're here hanging out and talking to people over drinks about stuff that aren't necessarily, I mean, because when you go to trade shows, I mean, this is like, to me, when I can tell when an industry is dying is when I go to the conference and I'm going up the escalator and the whole place is full of people who are buying and selling their products with each other. And that's when it becomes a trade show and no longer a conference. And here it's still great because here people are here trying to come up with new ideas while they're here rather than sell ideas that they came up with at home to each other. And so I think sending your people to places where you still have new stuff coming up, that's another way you can carve it out. But I do think that like letting people get their heads up occasionally is really important, as much as focus is on the process. But it's really, really hard because it's 35 million sounds like a lot, but it's not a lot if you're trying to feed 400 people. I mean, we have a pretty big ecosystem, and so we actually make it by with a lot less than say the nuclear physics group or the, you know, or the chemistry department. So it is a lot about how do you stay scrappy as you scale for me. But I don't know if that's a good answer. But thank you.
Can you move the mic back?
Yeah, I was going to do that. Yeah. I feel like I'm too close to be speaking this loudly.
Absolutely.
To you. That first question really got me. It kind of illuminates to me a really interesting kind of experience design question, because you talked about removing technology from experiences, and I think on another side you have a conversation about how to make things that you're experiencing more something that you actually have a seam full. You know, you hear these conversations about beautiful seams kind of interaction. I know, I say that just because I'm curious about each one of you have probably different flavors of thoughts flavored by the types of things that you're working on, as in terms of that balance between removing technology and making technology a part of the act of experience.
So I talked a little bit about this with some of our installation, but recently I've gotten really excited about sort of customization and wear, and I'm not sure actually if it sort of conflicts with this idea of consumer electronics, but imagine instead if this were made of like bronze or brass, you know, maybe copper, and as you carried it around in your pocket, it became stained and worn, and it really became unique and yours. Whereas, you know, how many people in this room have a white iPhone? You know, everyone, right? But really what I want is something that, you know, the more you love it, the more time you spend with it, the more it's yours, the more you become attached to it, right? And that's almost the opposite of what Henry was talking about, right? We're
go ahead, you can give your rebuttal.
Okay, all right. And so this is a conflicting opinion.
No. I don't want to get between you and your iPod love, so. but I want to further explain, because, you know, one of the researchers in our laboratory, Hugh Hare, he imagines like being able to pull on a pair of pants, and that those pants can amplify your ability to walk and run. So maybe you could run exerting the same amount of energy as you would riding a bicycle and more quickly get to anywhere. And my point is, if you had that pair of pants, you don't want to hold a joystick in order to say which way you want to go. You want to move it with your legs, just like you would move your legs anyway. So we want the technology. I'm not railing against our abilities to express ourselves, understand the world, and participate being amplified by technology. It should be. It should very much be amplified by technology. But what I'm saying is that we want to try to make that technology human-centered, and we approach it in a human way instead of something we need to be trained into new metaphors that serve no purpose other than to understand how to control the technology. And so that's kind of the point.
Just randomly riff off of this is Hugh Hare, who's one of our professors that you were just talking about, and he's a double amputee, and he's figured out, he's built a robotic ankle system and now working on knees. As you can see, even though he's lost both legs, he can walk without really any noticeable gait problem, and he's walking at approximately the same amount of energy expenditure as a normal human being. And it's interesting because the amount of, this is quite interdisciplinary because you've got to have robots, you've got to have understanding of locomotion, you have to understand biology and health. And then recently, one of the first conversations, the reason I brought this up was because I made a joke about tissue scientists, but literally Hugh said, I found out that the nerve endings, after you get amputation, you actually have this phantom pain. And there's some research around that, and then it turns out that the nerves will grow into fresh muscle tissue and fresh skin tissue. And he said, am I getting this wrong? No. And so he said, well, maybe if we could figure out a way to put tissue into the robotics, I can move my leg with my nerves, and then I could put tissue on the bottom of my prosthesis and feel the bottom of my feet. Joey, can we have a tissue scientist? And I was like, oh, okay, that sounds fine. And that's what's kind of cool, is that's why you could do that eventually in a mechanical engineering lab, but it would be very hard because it probably wouldn't fit under the grant that you currently were working on, and it would take a lot of energy. So even though, you know, this is very practical and practical, I mean, it's very mechanical and may not seem like media lab stuff, this is actually very media lab stuff because it requires a certain amount of agility in the types of people you would pull in to do this.
I think probably the most amazing thing about Hugh is I think he's probably in better shape than all of us.
Yeah, he runs in the morning.
I see him jogging every morning. It's unbelievable.
Hi, Joy. Hi. So the source map is what I care about. And I'm sure probably a lot of you care about that too, because that tells you if the things you buy come from bad people who are doing bad things to the world. My name's Nick, so maybe a little bit about me. I actually moved to Japan to work for a company that Joy was on the board of advisor of that kind of thing. So that's why I'm very passionate about that. But a little comment is, so I would like to get connected with whoever from Source Lab, but also I've got my new startup that's based in Hong Kong. We're doing the $300 3D printer. So we sort of know, like, the things that gets made in China. Like, I'm, like, totally against mass manufacturing. I want to switch that around. But it's so convoluted how the system works that it's really, really hard to get deep to where exactly the parts come from. So how exactly, you know, are they doing that? I'm really passionate to know, and I'm really passionate to help.
You're talking about super customization, or...?
But
more about anti-mass production.
Well, my own startup is
there's a great company that if you don't know, you should talk to, which is Liam Casey's PCH International. And they do supply chain for just about every product that that you may be using, although they don't say all the products that they do. but what's really interesting is they're pushing... They're talking to SourceMap. They're pushing transparency of supply chain, and they're actually based in Shenzhen. But he's an Irish guy who's in Shenzhen, and we're working closely with him. But it's really interesting because there's definitely a movement. So like SourceMap's being used by people like Office Depot and other people. It's interesting. The history of SourceMap was it was a crowdsourced project to try to get data so we can like out all those guys and show their supply chain. But it turns out the big companies say, well, we want to clean up our supply chain and show everybody and compete with people on how clean our supply chain is. So I think there's actually an interesting trend. And at least some of the supply chain people like PCH are trying to push their companies to be more transparent. Because in fact, I think in some cases, some of these guys are doing a better job on the supply chain and they're not getting credit for it. So it's like the sort of so it's an extension of the sort of becoming green movement. But I think that because something like SourceMap underneath has the crowdsourcing built into it, you can't just lie on SourceMap. People will check. And so I think having sort of a Wikipedia kind of SourceMap of supply chain, but having the companies start to opt into it is one really good way to sort of do some of the stuff that you're talking about.
So I would like to be one of those crowd to help
source
this.
We should talk about it. I mean, there's definitely a lot of stuff, even in China, going on around this. We just need to give them a little push.
Yep, cool. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
So I'm pretty excited about all the technology coming out, but one of the challenges I face a lot in the engineering we deal with is that there's sort of an anonymity that's been associated with the digital experience and digital persona. And as that gets mashed into a real physical space with me, so I'm walking into a room and there's an identification of me and there's persona and data information transferred, that has a knee-jerk reaction, I think, amongst most people of just like this kind of fear that comes out of that mashup of that information. So I think in the future, I can see that coming together, but I think in the short term, it's a big challenge we face is how to bridge those things together in a way that people are willing to accept and not reject the technology. So I'd just love to get a feedback on your perspective on that as you've kind of worked through these ideas.
I do know that we have a Sandy Pentland in our group is working a lot on privacy-enhancing technologies. He's working a little bit more on the big data and privacy issues, but the benefit that we have of being an academic institution is we're not necessarily driven by, you know, how do we just get more data so that we get more return? We're thinking about things like privacy issues and how do we think about the long term and how do we think about... And I was kind of half joking, but not really, about the fact that Silicon Valley startups really don't make standards and open APIs and things like that. And a lot of the privacy stuff, I think, involves getting people to the table and coming to agreements and things like that. Because it's really representing the people more than the companies in the short term. I think in the long term, there's a lot of economic arguments about why you should, why the users should control their data, why you shouldn't collect more data than you need. And eventually, I think, you know, privacy is this is a whole 2-hour conference that you could, you know, or more that you could do on it. But I think it really is like it was like before we cared about the environment, we were like dumping toxic waste. We're doing that with privacy stuff right now, and there's going to be a lot of pain. And just like when spam came out, we're going to realize, oh, crap, we've created a system that kind of sucks. And then I think we're going to have to iterate on it to make it better. But right now the problem is I think the people don't feel enough pain, and companies react to customer needs. They don't react to policy decisions. And so we're going to be working on a lot of technologies that will help address those pains once they become a little bit more public. But I think that one of the problems is that the average user will still use stuff, even though it should be pretty creepy for them. But it is a big area of research for us. And so if you're interested in that space, we can definitely talk more about that. And we have 2 minutes left. One more.
Just real quick, you mentioned 3D printing during your talk. I was wondering what specifically are y'all doing with additive manufacturing, digital fabrication technology, and if you have any interface with Neil Gershenfeld and his program at MIT.
So Neil's on the first floor of our lab. I think he's got probably the most popular class at MIT with a 3-year waiting list called How to Build Almost Anything.
How to make almost anything.
How to make almost anything. And I think I'm going to try to create a version of how to grow almost anything. So he's part of the lab community. He has his own center, and he's still part of our MAS academic program. So he's a very important part of the infrastructure of the Media Lab, which is to be able to go down to the basement and fabricate stuff. And then there's definitely the Fab Lab movement that kind of comes out of Neil's place. And then there's a not completely connected but very importantly related hackerspace movement. And then we have Leah, who's plugged into the maker movement, and she'll be speaking as well. And the kind of combination of that, at least in terms of community, we're sort of plugged in. And then we've got, you know, we're very involved in Arduino and LilyPad and stuff like that. I do think that the spin-outs of the Media Lab are working more on things like creating 3D printers and things like that. And we work with a lot of the big companies. I think mainly we're just heavy users of this stuff. And so we kind of, and we connect it into all these other things. And so, and we're pretty open about letting other people come in and play with it. Other than that, I mean, I think, you know, we like toys, unfortunately. And they're the coolest new toys. And so thank you, everybody. Hope that you can see some of our other sessions.